the DoorDash, Grubhub, and Uber Eats of the world, and there are a few other, like Easy Cater is out there now, some other ones, but they're kind of the lifeblood of the ghost kitchen or dark kitchen concept because they're truly the partners that make it happen, right? So a ghost kitchen has a lot of different definitions. We look at it, we actually internally call it a dark kitchen, meaning that the areas of your kitchen that are dark, the lights are off, right, that aren't being used, is space that restaurants aren't utilizing to create more, generate more revenue for themselves.
Can you talk about the importance of speed for your brand?
We look at speed as one of our advantages. And if we have speed to market and we can get to market faster than other companies, especially in like retail, or expand our ghost kitchens from zero to 500 plus in 3 years, right? Somebody else can't do it.
Welcome to Farm to Fork, The Innovators. I'm your host, David Maloney, president of Datum FS, and I've spent over four decades navigating the twists and turns of the food supply chain. On this podcast, we're diving deep into the stories and strategies that are reshaping the way we produce, distribute, and serve our food. Our guest innovator today is Brandon Tamaro, Vice President of Strategic Growth at WowBow. In recent years, WowBow has gone from 10 physical restaurants to having their brand in over 600 ghost kitchens and nearly 5,000 retail outlets. In this episode, you'll discover the triumphs and obstacles in expanding your brand into delivery and ghost kitchens, the rapid journey of WowBow into retail, including over 3,000 Walmart locations within a year, the financial growth beyond WowBow stores and its effects on their supply chain, and insights into WowBow's people, culture, and strategies that drive its flourishing success. So buckle up, hit that subscribe button, and let's harvest progress together. This is Farm to Fork, The Innovators, where the future of the food supply chain starts with this episode. But real quick, I'd like to introduce you to Datum Advisors, a new offering from Datum FS. Our team comprises seasoned food supply chain executives from every sector with over three centuries of collective experience. We stand ready to offer valuable advisory services for your company. Drawing from my past experiences, leveraging a team of advisors played a pivotal role in our strategic planning and go-to-market strategies. The potential benefits extend beyond these aspects, including project work, presenting numerous opportunities for the industry. For further details, visit datumfs.com and click on the advisors link. All right, so let's jump in with Brandon Tamaro. Brandon, tell us about yourself.
Hey, David. Great to be here. So my name is Brandon Tamaro. I am the VP of Strategic Growth at WowBow. I've been in the supply chain industry for around 9 years now, graduated from University at Buffalo in New York. From there, I went over to C.H. Robinson, worked there for about 2 years, then over to Kraft Heinz, where I spent the bulk of my career, about four and a half, almost 5 years, across a bunch of different roles. And starting in 2021, I joined the WowBow team and am still here today and having fun growing.
Cool. So we're going to spend most of our discussion today on WowBow, but let's talk about your supply chain background first, because I think it's interesting just in the different departments or silos you've been in, right? So let's start with C.H. Robinson. Tell us who C.H. Robinson is and how you got into it, and maybe what you learned from it, and maybe what your challenges and successes were.
For sure. C.H. Robinson is a third-party logistics company, and they do a little bit other than that as well. They do some importing and a lot of produce as well, but the bulk of the business is in third-party logistics, where basically they're the middleman between the customer and the truck driver, and they're connecting freight that needs to go somewhere with the driver. And I started there, 9 years ago is my first kind of real job out of college. And I didn't really know much about C.H. Robinson or what they did or even who they were, just like a lot of college kids, I needed a job and seemed interesting. So I took it and I loved it. I fell in love with it. I had an amazing mentor and boss named Jim Wasicki, and he's still there. He's been there for 30 years and taught me a ton about his accounts. And it led to me taking on my own account, which I'll give a shout out to his cabinets to go down in Tennessee, where I was. We were a full outsource customer with them. And basically, we ran 100% of their freight operations out of Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, across all the country to all their locations. And I really got an amazing experience with them. I got to be down on site once a week for a full week every month and sit with their team, and I got to learn a lot, their warehouse operations, their freight operations, everything from their sales, and how it all connected through the supply chain, and how important the freight part was to getting their customers product when they needed product. So being able to, you know, really just own their whole freight operation was super important to learning, and obviously them executing their business strategy and growing and succeeding. And they're still doing really well to this day.
Interesting. And so C.H. Robinson has a is it fair to say C.H. Robinson has a pretty big presence in the food supply chain?
Big time.
Particularly for food service.
Big time. I mean, I got to, you know, I sat across when we were obviously in office then, and got to sit across from the Kraft Heinz, where I ended up going, but the Kraft Heinz pod, they called it, in, you know, 25 people working on just Kraft Heinz freight all day. Then there was the Nestle pod and the, you know, Black and Decker pod, you know, name the customer, but they're running hundreds and thousands of loads and trucks a day for these customers and making sure that product's getting to where it needs to be and managing fines and detentions and all the intricacies that come with freight management.
Cool. So let's talk about Kraft, or Kraft Heinz, I should say.
Yeah.
So you left, went to Kraft Heinz. What was your role there, and what were kind of your challenges and successes?
Yeah. So I left C.H. Robinson to go to Kraft Heinz. I wanted to be more on the supplier side, and really just an amazing experience overall. I didn't know fully what I was getting into, but I'm really happy for the experience I had there. I started in a kind of a hybrid customer sales and supply chain role. It was really the connection between the sales team at Kraft Heinz and then the customer, which is the grocery store, so Publix or Ahold Delhaize, and making sure that all the parties were always talking about new item launches or limited time offers, LTOs, et cetera. And that experience just in that role itself, you know, was extremely valuable, you know, hearing all the, obviously everyone has an issue in such a big company with another party, you know, the sales team didn't tell the demand team, that didn't tell the supply team. So being able to connect and kind of see the whole picture of everything that needs to happen to make like a new item launch go happen, like a new Lunchable flavor, you think it's pretty easy for such a big company, but getting Chips Ahoy into a Lunchable is not as easy as it sounds. So a lot of conversation has to go on from a lot of different parties. And seeing all that really helped me kind of grow and understand, you know, how important the execution side of it was.
Yeah, and particularly in the industry today for food service, LTOs, or like you said, limited time offers, have grown substantially. Is that fair?
Yes, extremely. And, you know, we did a ton with our food service division at Kraft Heinz, you know, ran out of a few different plants, but just the different items and the ever-changing landscape of it. I remember when Chick-fil-A launched the Kraft Heinz dippable cup, where you can pull off the lid and then dip it, or you can squeeze, right? Well, that obviously comes with a big demand shift in other squeezable ketchups, because if Chick-fil-A is changing, that's a lot of demand going down and a lot of new demand coming up. So dealing through that and, you know, having the question asked, you know, why do we have 70 weeks of stock of squeezable packs and not enough stock of this? And, you know, having to deal with customers always wanting to change is extremely important, but it kind of goes back to the sales team and talking to the customer demand team and supply team, making sure everyone's always on the same page.
And it's fair to say that those squeezable dipping ketchups have been successful.
Yes, extremely. I mean, I don't prefer to dip my fries in anything else but one of those.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we have some downstairs.
Yeah, especially with the waffle fries at Chick-fil-A. You need the bigger cup.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to a company like Kraft Heinz being listening to their customer, mm-hmm. right? I think that's a great story.
Big time.
Well, thanks for that. So you leave and you go to WowBow. But before we jump into that, maybe first, who is WowBow? Then let's talk about how you got to WowBow.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So WowBow is it's hard to fully describe, but I'll describe this as a fast casual Asian concept. We started as a part of Let Us Entertain You Brands, which is a Chicago restaurant group, in 2003. One of the chefs of Let Us Entertain You, his name is Bruce Koss, pretty famous chef, went to China, ate bao while he was in China, and brought it back to Richard Melman, who's the founder of Let Us Entertain You, and made some for him in America. And they ate it and were like, we have to build a concept over this product. It's not here anywhere. It's going to be amazing. So they built a whole concept, WowBow, and we launched the first physical restaurant location in Chicago in Water Tower Place, which is by the old Macy's, but old where Macy's used to be. They're not there anymore, but right on Michigan Avenue. And from there, it just kind of grew into what it is now, which we can get into later. But it's started at the heart of everything, all about the restaurant, and based around a simple product like the Bao.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more here in a second. So you said Wild Bao was started as a brick and mortar restaurant in 2003. Mm-hmm. And that evolution of the brand was generally in brick and mortar.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yes. So we expanded through Chicago in other ways as well, doing like sports stadiums. We were in Guaranteed Rate Field when it was Kaminsky Park. We were at Camden Yard, the Seattle Seahawks football stadium. So a lot of that, and then also music festivals, doing different things. We started doing Lollapalooza in Chicago, which is the biggest music festival in the country. We started doing that in 2012, and we've done it every year since. So Jeff, who's our president and CEO, it has been since 2009, has always been a forefront of kind of being an innovator and on edge of what's new, what's next, and never afraid to try something. So we've done a million things, and it's kind of helped Wild Bao have this whole presence of, innovative fun. And it speaks to the Bao, because the Bao is kind of even though it's been around for thousands of years in China, it is an innovative and fun product for a lot of Americans who've never tried it. So yeah, brick and mortar festivals to dark kitchens, ghost kitchens, and grocery stores. So it's been a ride.
Yeah. I think most of your growth over the last couple of years is, before we get into retail, was in the ghost kitchen space. And Wild Bao is, for those who don't know, well documented their move into the ghost kitchen. And actually, I'll let Brandon define ghost kitchen for us all here in a second. But one of the leaders, and if not still the leader in the ghost kitchen space, one of the biggest brands, let's just put it that way, in the ghost kitchen space. So how many ghost kitchens are you in now?
Yeah, so we're 500 plus ghost kitchens across the U.S. and Canada.
Okay. And define a ghost kitchen for us, and then we'll talk about the space here in a little bit. But
so a ghost kitchen has a lot of different definitions. We look at it, we actually internally call it a dark kitchen, meaning that the areas of your kitchen that are dark, the lights are off, right, that aren't being used, is space that restaurants aren't utilizing to generate more revenue for themselves. So Wild Bao has a unique business proposition, which I'll dive a little bit more into, that we can easily fill that space and generate revenue for a restaurant and help you either fund another employee or, have bigger bonuses, et cetera, et cetera. And the way we do that is just delivery only, DoorDash, Grubhub, and Uber Eats, and being able to give customers a whole different restaurant, basically, out of your restaurant, your brick and mortar restaurant that you're serving, whatever, pizza, pasta, Mediterranean food out of.
Yeah. So for those, and Brandon, you may not know this, but my family bought a restaurant a couple years ago in downtown Sarasota. Mm-hmm. And it's a bakery, coffee shop, cafe. And I'll give a plug. It's called Pastry Art. Best place on earth if you're ever in Sarasota. Anyways, I am, as a businessman, struck by how many hours a day our bakery and kitchen is vacant. And it's probably 14, 15, 16 hours a day.
Wow.
Right. And so I'm always thinking about the opportunity there. Could we get into what other opportunities are out there, whether that would be wholesale bakery or something like that? How do we leverage it?
Right.
I think Wild Bao, what's interesting, and people may say, well, I don't have a big space to operate. But I think one of the intriguing things about Wild Bao, correct me if I'm wrong, is the amount of space needed to produce a food, correct?
Big time, yeah. So yeah. Wild Bao was built, and this goes all the way back to, honestly, the restaurant days. And I'll kind of walk through the whole evolution. Is Wild Bao was created as something that didn't need a lot of space. So our first restaurant, which I talked about in 2003, that we opened was 300 square feet. If you've been to Water Tower, you look at it and you're like, where is the kitchen? Where is everything, right? It's all there. So what allowed us to do that was, from the inception of the concept, everything had to be manufactured, right? There couldn't be in-house prep. There couldn't be people making bao in the back room. So what was established in 2003 was a supply chain of manufacturing in a USDA facility, right? The whole menu. How do we make bao? How do we make pot stickers, dumplings, et cetera? And that's ever evolved to what we have now is 14 external manufacturers across the country that are doing our different products for us and helping us grow. But we took that small concept and idea and expanded that to our airport locations. We started opening in airports, and our business proposition to these airports was, hey, you have that coffee shop that closed down or that tea shop, and it's this tiny space that no one wants to go into. Why don't you bring Wild Bao in? We'll fill it, and you'll be able to generate X amount more revenue than a tea shop will bring you or a gift shop. And that kind of went all the way through to the same concept as dark kitchens, ghost kitchens, where you have this little space in your corner, right? It's not big enough. I don't have enough room. Well, for Wild Bao, you need about 8 feet of space. You just need a induction burner, a steamer, and a pan that you can griddle some pot stickers in. And basically, you can run the entire concept. So really small footprint and really easy to execute. Our Jeff, our CEO, always says you just need to know how to boil water and you can run Wild Bao. And that's really as simple as it gets.
So can you walk through the model of the delivery, right? You mentioned Grubhub, mm-hmm. just in case. I'm sure everybody knows who Grubhub, DoorDash, and Uber Eats are. But how does that work with the ghost kitchens in general, and how has that worked for Wild Bao?
Yeah, so the DoorDash, Grubhub, and Uber Eats of the world, and there are a few other like Easy Cater is out there now, some other ones, but they're kind of the lifeblood of the ghost kitchen or dark kitchen concept because they're truly the partners that make it happen, right? So our first step of onboarding is, you know, David, you say you want your bakery to turn into a Wild Bao, right? The first step would be opening up your restaurant on DoorDash. So the Wild Bao team provides the marketing materials, the setup information. We're the ones talking to DoorDash saying, okay, Wild Bao's opening a location. Here's our, you know, logo. Here's the coordinates of the address, everything. And now when the customer, you know, is sitting in their house in Sarasota and they open up their DoorDash app and they see what's new and it says Wild Bao, that's what's coming through to them. And that's how we get to that point of sale purchase, is showing that it's not just you can't just name the concept of whatever you're running, anything you want. It's Wild Bao. It's a restaurant. It has a brand. It has a following, et cetera.
And the food is delivered through either yes. Uber Eats, DoorDash, or Grubhub.
Exactly. Your order goes through there and it routes right to your kitchen, right? So we'll go to your POS system or your tablet, whatever you have connected. And then your kitchen will make the food and then put it out. The DoorDash driver shows up and driver takes it and delivers it to the customer. And customer gets to enjoy their food.
So the word that's jumping out at me is this all seems pretty simple. Simplified space, small space, simplified cooking or heating of the food, mm-hmm. simplified delivery and marketing mechanism mm-hmm. through Uber Eats. So the restaurant owner doesn't need to do a whole lot. Is that fair?
Yes, very fair.
Yeah. And I can tell you from a restaurateur perspective, it's the business, for those of you who don't know the business, it is a pennies business. For ticket, you are scratching for every sale you can get. Mm-hmm. And particularly what's interesting about the ghost kitchen space is it gives that restaurateur an opportunity to test stuff, to provide a feedback loop. Is that fair?
Yeah, definitely.
So we're going to talk about the ghost kitchen space a little more in general. I'd like to get your opinions because, like I said earlier, I think Wild Bao is probably one of, if not the leader in this space. But you've also got some real exciting news of what's going on with the company, right? And you've transitioned into retail, and you want to just give us an overview on that?
Yeah. So really exciting stuff that A, already happened, and B, in the pipeline for 2024. But when I started, we did have a retail presence. So we started doing basically retail or CPG grocery store business in about 2015 to 2016, where our CEO, Jeff, basically knocked on the back door at Jewel Osco. This was when it was easy to get into grocery stores, easier, and knocked on the back door at Jewel Osco and was like, hey, we're local, serve our product. And we created some packaging and they started doing it. They took it in and they expanded it. So we had a local kind of CPG presence from about 2015 to 2021-ish when I started. And when I looked at it, it kind of seemed like a no-brainer to expand this. Like, we have a very unique product. People love Bao. It's hot. It's, you know, being Googled. We have a bunch of data from Grubhub, Google, DoorDash, et cetera. Like, the percent growth of Bao, just the term, is up like 350% year over year. And it keeps continuing. So it's a product that's not on the shelves anywhere, and it's a product people are looking for, right? And we're manufacturing it at a high level and a high output, and grocery stores want to expand their Asian offering. So it seemed kind of like a no-brainer at the time to see if we could make a run at this. So we kind of redesigned our packaging. And one thing to know about retail is if your costs aren't in order, you're going to get killed or slaughtered right when you start. So getting kind of the costing structure of how we're going to do it with advertising and slotting fees and all that in order. And then we started making a push at some grocery stores, and we landed a meeting with Walmart down in Bentonville about, it was November of 2022, so a year ago, and presented to the buyer the line that we wanted to do. And she tried the items and, you know, fell in love with them and the idea of Wow Bao being in Walmart. So she committed at the spot to 1,500 locations with 5 SKUs. And then about a couple months before launch, I got an email that said it was actually going to be 3,000 stores, not 1,500, which to a salesperson is music to their ears, and a supply chain person, it's like, oh man, how are we going to make this happen? So my first call was to our manufacturer. His name's Brett. And I was like, I go, Brett, I got good news and bad news, man. And we were able to pull it off and hit the timelines needed to launch. So we launched in August, and we're in 3,000 Walmarts now across the country, and, you know, having a ton of success through Walmart, which is awesome. So we also have 1,000 other grocery stores in addition to Walmart, and that number is growing. We hope to be over 10,000 by the end of 2024.
So let's come back to the ghost kitchen space in a minute. Let's stay on this retail with this momentum we have here, right?
Yeah.
Why go this route? I mean, the obvious answer is, hey, we're going to make some money.
Right.
Right. But you talk about it sounds like the company is a pretty fun place to work.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Innovative. I wrote it down earlier, some words over innovation, fun, and I'm guessing not afraid to fail.
Definitely not.
Right. Which is very important.
I tried a pumpkin pie Bao that had orange dough the other day in the office. So
yeah,
not the definition of fun. I don't know what is.
So why go to retail? What are the benefits besides the obvious that the company is going to make money?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Something we talked about a lot internally as well. And our approach at Wow Bao and Jeff's approach, our CEO, has always been to meet the customer where they want Bao, right? Find the customer where they want us. And delivery after COVID, obviously, was extremely popular, right? Everyone was getting delivery. I was maybe twice or three times a week using the apps. And then over time, you know, you could start going out to restaurants. And I think that delivery usage went down. And we saw that trend. And I'm sure we'll get more into that. It's not that it's ever going away, because I don't believe that. But customers kind of were just looking for different things and not as much on delivery. And maybe they're going back to the grocery store. So internally, we said, what's the harm in saying, hey, this is the same product. There's no difference of the product at the restaurant, the ghost kitchen, the airports, or the grocery store. Why shouldn't we give the product the option to buy it and make it at home for their family for a reduced cost, right? It's no secret to anyone that delivery is a little expensive, but there's a convenience that goes along with it. But if you're willing to go to Walmart and pick up 6 different packages of Bao and do a whole dim sum platter for your family, why shouldn't you be able to do that and spend, you know, a fraction of the cost that you're spending on DoorDash or Grubhub?
And I want to be clear here, this success that you're having, remind me, you have a fairly small amount of when I say brick and mortar, I mean actually physical locations of restaurants.
Yes, correct. We have 3 in Chicago, and then we do have 7 airport locations. Now they're licensee deals, so that's more of the franchise model, but they are brick and mortar locations that if you're in the airport, you would see the sign that says Wow Bao, et cetera. So in total, you could call it 10.
Yeah. So I think what's striking here, and I want to talk about this in a little bit, but is just the evolution of the company, right? and perhaps the potential best practices that you all have learned that maybe there's another brand out there, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, that say, hey, look, I don't have to have 2,000 locations to go into retail.
Right.
Right. I don't have to have, I mean, you've created that brand. I think that's what's the most remarkable thing here is the brand, the Wild Bao brand that's been created.
Right.
Right. With right now just 10 restaurants, right?
Right.
It's remarkable.
It's obviously amazing when you're, you know, selling into retail and somebody's heard of you or even eaten it. A great story I had about a month ago, we got on a call with a UNFI buyer who is one of the big CPG distributors in the country. And I joined the call and the first thing she said was, I love Wild Bao. I get it delivered every week. And she lives in Rhode Island. So
cool.
She knew about Wild Bao from our ghost kitchens, right? And we have customers that do the same thing. And the brand has been built and it hasn't been easy, right? It's 20 years of building, right? So this isn't an overnight success story or anything. We've been doing Lollapalooza for over 10 years, right? There's so much that it's not easy to create a brand and no one will say it is. And Wild Bao has been able to do that through 20 years of quality and innovation and growing through all these different platforms.
Yeah.
With 10 restaurant locations.
Yeah. So I think that one of the important words that strikes me here or that I'm thinking about now is the company's been pretty persistent.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair?
Oh, yeah. And right. Through a lot of different times, right?
Yeah.
Through crashes, good and bad.
Yeah. So there's a if I hear you correctly, going into retail, I think there's something you said that's really important for any brand is meeting the customers where they want to get the product. Mm-hmm. Right. Not dictating where the customers have to get it.
Right.
Right. But meeting them as many places as you can. And I want to talk about the kiosks in a little bit, because actually I have a connection there that's a Sarasota based company. And I know the people involved with the company or the investors, excuse me, is a Sarasota based company. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about retail a little bit more. So what are the major challenges in entering the retail space? Because I'm sure there's people out there going to say, hey, I've got a great brand. I've got a great product. Like what were the major challenges you faced entering and then maybe then thriving in retail, right?
Yeah, there's so much that, I mean, we could have a whole separate podcast on, I think, just retail. There's so much that goes into it. And obviously my experience at Kraft Heinz helped me a ton navigate that. And I definitely don't have all the answers, still don't, but knowing who to call and be like, hey, tell me about this or what do I need to be prepared for? But the costing was definitely the biggest piece it's so different than food service and figuring that out. And obviously cost is important to everyone, but food service cost is, you know, you sell it to the restaurant or you sell it to whoever and that's the sale. And it's pretty straightforward. Here's your margin, right? In retail, there's so many costs that go into it. The distributor takes a piece. The retailer wants to make X percent and they won't make anything less. Then you have to market the product and that has to take 10 to 15% too. And then just to be on the shelf, most grocery stores are going to charge you a slotting fee, which can be some grocery stores charge $80,000 a SKU, some charge a free case. Like it just depends. So having your cost in line and going to market with a cost that makes sense for you to succeed was one of the biggest things I would say that I obviously had to do a ton of research and learn about, but we had to have that straight before we went to market. Cause there's a lot of, you know, horror stories you hear. You go to market and then you realize everything is wrong with your cost and then you're going under and there's nothing you can do about it. So that's the biggest piece that, you know, we had to get figured out at the beginning. And then the evolution and growth of it, I have to say is just how many grocery stores there are. I worked at Kraft Heinz for 5 years and I had no idea there were this many grocery stores in the whole country. Like, you know, about Kroger, Albertsons, Publix, Walmart, but there's so many 100 store, 50 store, 120 store chains out there. And when you add them all up, it adds to, you know, 10,000 grocery stores. So being able to prioritize the right stores that fit your brand and your product, and then get a meeting with them, be able to have distribution through supply chain to them, because some of them might want your product, but you have no way to get it to them cost effectively. And then managing that with your production capacities, how, you know, if I bring on 10,000 grocery stores in the Q1 of next year, how can we even keep up with that type of volume? So connecting all of the dots of growth has been a challenge and won't stop being a challenge, but it's been fun to figure out.
And so what does success look like for WowBao in retail?
It's a great question. And we really view ourselves as kind of that next Asian brand that consumers can trust at retail. And I listen and read a lot about, you know, brand strategies, everything. And a lot of brands, you know, have a strategy. I want to be the natural market brand, right? I want to be Whole Foods, Sprouts, the Fresh Market, or I'm conventional. I want to be Target and Walmart, right? WowBao, and might call it silly or might call it, you know, misadvised, but we want to be everywhere. We think that Bao is a food for everyone. There's not a certain type of person that eats Bao more than the other. We think everyone can eat it. And we want to be across the chains everywhere, serving Bao to people and letting them know what Bao is and growing that, and then growing our other products underneath that, right? Bao pot stickers, fried rice. So we really see ourselves as, not to compare us to PF Chang's, but PF Chang's has, in most grocery stores, 5 or 6 rows of products, right? And we think that WowBao can be that, we can be that more, you know, providing the brand that consumers understand and know. And that's going to bring them fun, innovative things like a cheeseburger Bao and a pizza Bao. So we want to stay true to ourselves, but we also want to keep providing high quality food that you can get in a restaurant or that you can get in a grocery store.
Fascinating. And I probably should ask this question earlier, so step back for a second. Define for the audience what a Bao is.
Great question. So a Bao is a soft, fluffy dough, Bao bun. It's just a white dough, basically. And it's filled with either a sweet or a savory filling. Traditionally in China, a Bao is a grab-and-go type food, a breakfast food sometimes, and something quick, cheap that you can get almost anywhere. And, you know, it's hard to almost describe it to anything like it in the U.S. because there's not really anything like it. But it's steamed and it's not baked or it's not. You can do different things with it, but our preferred method is steaming it. So it's really soft. It's really fluffy. And it's just like a nice quick bite. We're 2.5 ounces. So you're looking like 200 calories per single bao. So you can really eat it as a meal, right? You can eat a couple of them for a meal, or you can do it as a snack or a lunch. So super multifaceted and super delicious.
So my first thought goes to, and you have some Pittsburgh roots, is a pierogi.
Yes.
Familiar with a pierogi? Yes. Okay.
It is, yes. It's just like, it's very similar to a pierogi or even like a dumpling or a hot pocket or anything like that. Same concept.
But a ravioli,
right.
We'll bring our Italian in here, buddy.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And what strikes me is the story of Starbucks and Howard Schultz and him going to Italy in these espresso bars and saying, wait a minute, this is what we need, these in America, right? And to create that brand. Is it fair to say, and if I remember correctly, you were saying the chef had gone to China and seen them, right? And how common they were. Boy, we can create this brand here in the United States. It's fair to say similar stories.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it's, you know, finding something that wasn't being done in the United States. And if it was at a, you know, small local levels, right? Or maybe in like Chinatown in New York City or Chinatown in Chicago, right? They're being done. But at a full scale, it's like, how do you, right? The same thing as Howard Schultz. How do you bring this concept that people definitely love, right? It's a whole country of it. And how do you bring it to the masses in the United States? Because I think that's always the challenge, is bringing it to the masses of people, right? Like even just Chicago, I wouldn't consider the masses. It's a city, big city in the United States, but how do you bring it to Alabama? How do you bring it to Sarasota? How do you bring it to North Carolina, right? There's a lot of green space out there that doesn't come to Chicago. So that's been really the whole goal of WowBao, is to bring Bao to everyone out there.
I think Andy has reminded me a couple times that there's no Wow the Bao's in Sarasota.
Yeah, that, well.
Hint, David. Hint.
You have Walmart by you. I have a wedding down in Sarasota in February, so I can bring some Bao.
Okay, well, you got to come to the pastry
art. Come to the pastry art.
That's right. So let's briefly, because I think the conversation, which is most intriguing to me, quite honestly, is just the brand you're creating.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I do want to talk about the ghost kitchen space.
Yeah.
And so briefly, you mentioned during COVID, obviously ghost kitchen space became very popular, but that's starting to change. Is that fair?
Definitely. Definitely changing.
Okay. So can you kind of give us an update on the ghost kitchen space and what are the major challenges there?
Yeah.
Et cetera.
I would honestly compare it a little bit to like almost, like sports gambling or something like that, where it started and it was kind of anyone could do whatever they wanted with ghost kitchens. And then regulations started coming in and people had to change how they were doing it. And as you get more data and do something long enough, you kind of see the tail and the winners and the losers of all of this. So it started and anyone could open a ghost kitchen. There were restaurants opening ghost kitchens with, you know, you run a pizza shop, Brandon's Pizza, and then you open up David's Pizza and Jim's Pizza and all these pizzas that serve the exact same menu items as the brick and mortar, but you're creating like 50 virtual brands so that you just have more placement on DoorDash and Uber Eats so that you're collecting more orders and trying to drive sales. Hmm. That's not the really concept of a ghost kitchen, right? You're just reserving your food under a different name and you're almost fooling customers, right? It's not Jim's Pizza. It's Brandon's Pizza. That's the same pizza. So that was happening a lot. And then there were other, you know, concepts like the Reef Kitchens of the world who were starting, you know, these vessels where they were doing a multiple ghost kitchens. And then there were like David Chang had his Momofuku chicken restaurant. They tried to do it. So a lot of trial and error with what worked and what didn't in the ghost kitchen space. And it's really evolved a lot. The DoorDash has came in and struck down. You can't have the same menu items on your brick and mortar menu as you do your virtual concept menu. So they shut down, I think it was one day, they shut down like 50,000 virtual restaurants on the app. So a lot of regulation has come in. And then I think a lot of people started to understand like how hard it was to, it's supposed to be simple. And it was becoming not simple, right? Some brands were running, or some restaurants were running 10 virtual concepts, 15 at the same time. And their items, they didn't have streamlines across their items, or it wasn't easy enough to cook. And then it just became, your reviews were terrible. So demand just kind of went down. So a lot of closures like that. And really who's won is the people who've kept it the most simple. So, you know, Wild Bao is, we have 14 items. You don't have to really do anything other than order 14 items and cook them, right? That's very simple to do. A lot of brands like Doghouse is one that has had a lot of success. They run a concept called Badass Breakfast Burritos out of their 40 locations. And all of the items in their breakfast burritos are also used in their main concept. So there's a ton of crossover. And those are the ones who have really succeeded running these. And we're glad to be at the top of it. But we were basically doing this, right, with our airports and our restaurants already. So it was a really easy transition for us and not as easy for a lot of these other concepts to transform into the ghost kitchen space.
Is it fair to say that the Bao and your products deliver well?
They definitely deliver well. They sit well, which is a huge plus. It's like pizza almost, where
right.
It's kind of almost a little better after it cools down a little bit. You don't want it to be piping hot into your mouth because you're going to burn yourself. So it definitely delivers well. And what we found a lot is like the key with delivery in a lot of areas is it needs to reheat well. Because regardless of how hot you make it and everything, stuff happens with those drivers. I've watched my driver drive to the West Loop when I live in Gold Coast, and you get your food and it's freezing cold. So if it doesn't reheat well, then you're in trouble. So the Bao reheat well, you can do it in the microwave, pot sticker, same thing. So that's been a big help in kind of the evolution of Wild Bao as a ghost kitchen.
Yeah. And so for those out there, correct me if I'm wrong, Brandon, but I think that the quality of the food and the acceptance of reheating it, mm-hmm. right, by the customer is vitally important. So you mentioned pizza, mm-hmm. right? I think the quality of the pizza, delivered pizza, has gotten so much better over the last two decades. Mm-hmm. And we're all very comfortable. We all love leftover pizza, right? I'm not a cold pizza guy. I got to heat it up, right? But we all love leftover pizza. You know, chicken wings, I think, deliver well from the standpoint that we're just kind of used to it and we can reheat them a little bit. Mm-hmm. And yes, the quality may suffer some, but they deliver well. But there are foods out there that just struggle. And French fries is one of them.
Right.
How do you reheat a hamburger on a bun?
Right.
It's tough.
It is.
It's very hard. So is it fair to say for those who may be saying, hey, I want to get into the ghost kitchen space with my products, they need to be very careful. I mean, with their products, what they're serving, they need to be very methodical about what they're selling and serving.
Definitely. What you're delivering, the quality, you know, you need to test how it is after 30 and 40 minutes. We do that all the time, is we have food come from the store to the office and we let it sit for 40 minutes and then try it, because that's how the customer is going to be trying the product. And you have to think about all that stuff and what the implications are of delivering cold food and getting a bad rating, right? You can't have poor ratings on these services or you're not going to get orders. That's always a battle for us, because it's not, at the end of the day, it's not our Wildbound employees cooking the product, right? It's another employee. So how do you get them to care as much as we care about the product and deliver that good stuff to the customer?
Hmm. Cool. And so, speaking of reheatable, you are in kiosks now, correct?
Yes. The vending machine, the Wildbound vending machine.
Yes.
Yep.
And so can you tell us a little bit about that evolution?
For sure. So we, again, I mentioned a couple of times, Jeff loves to innovate and loves to kind of be on the trend, and hot food vending machines have been a thing in kind of Asia for a while, but they are making their way to the U.S. now. And we got approached from a company that was specializing in hot food vending machines, and they loved the concept of maybe having Bao in their vending machine. So we played around with it and did a lot of testing. Basically, these vending machines are almost like giant microwaves. At the end of the day, really powerful, but basically a microwave. So you can cook a Bao really well in a microwave. It's our preferred route on retail. So it's really easy to do. And we struck a partnership with them to expand Bao to all of these locations. We even did some stuff with branded, like Wild Bao branded vending machines, as well as just being in their base vending machine. So we're all over college campuses, we're sports stadiums, wherever the customer is and wants a fast, convenient snack. Wabao is ready to be there.
Cool. And a shout out to this vending company.
Just Baked is their name. They're great partners and have really helped us grow.
Cool. All right. So I'm going to spend a few minutes on the Wabao supply chain, right? Because we'll probably have a lot of listeners that, given my background, are going to be supply chain focused. What does that look like? And how do you... You talked about earlier, can I deliver cost effectively? Do I have capacity? I mean, these are very important supply chain issues, right? So maybe walk us through, what does the supply chain look like and what are your major challenges and successes?
Yeah, for sure. So the Wabao supply chain has grown a ton over the last 2 years. And one of the key partners that we have that can help us expand is Dot Foods. So they're kind of the hub of our supply chain, really. And Dot Foods, for people who aren't familiar with them, they're known as a redistributor. So think of the level up from your Sysco or PFG or US Foods. And basically Dot Foods will house our products and then allow us to hit any distributor out there. And they're really the key to helping us grow, because as we grew our airport business, we found that Airport One wanted to open, but they used US Foods as their distributor. Then Airport Two wanted to open and they wanted Sysco as their distributor, right? And the last thing we wanted to do was turn down business and be like, hey, we only work with US Foods or we only work with Sysco. So Dot Foods, for an added cost, obviously allowed us to say, we're not saying no to anyone, right? We'll get to you no matter who you are and how you want your product. So they are really the help there, and all of our manufacturing sites will ship into Dot Foods. So that's kind of been our trick to be able to expand as fast as we have and being able to really hit anyone across the country. And as Dot Foods has even grown with us, they've started like a CPG side of their business, and they also have a Walmart program that they do. And they do all of our Walmart deliveries to the Walmart DC. So not only on the food service side have they been able to help us grow, but also on the CPG side. And it's really important to have a good partner like that, because some of the things you avoid are, like, at Kraft Heinz, we had a ton of warehouses that we owned, obviously, and we had employees in that shipped out to Kroger's and, you know, different Sysco's, et cetera. We don't have to have our own warehousing for us at Wabao. We ship right from our external manufacturers right to Dot Foods. And as long as we plan our production and demand forecast right, we should never have to have product that has to go somewhere else, right? Dot Food should take it as long as we stay within these parameters. So a lot goes in on the back end. We have a lot of internal tools that we track forecasts and we watch our weeks of stock and all this good stuff and make sure we're planning production at the right levels. But that's kind of a trick that we've been using for, we've been partnered with Dot for almost 7 years now, and they've really helped us grow really quickly.
And so for those who may not know, a redistributor like Dot Foods sits between the food service distributor that you mentioned, Brandon, Sysco, US Foods, PFG, et cetera, and between a manufacturer like Kraft Heinz. So is a well-established model in the food service space already. Yeah. So you're just tapping into something. You didn't create it. You just tapped into it, right?
We tapped into it, right. And it allows, and what's great about it is it allows the Sysco's and the US Foods of the world to order one case of something or two cases, right? They don't have to take full pallets. So Dot creates a ton of efficiencies where Sysco says, all right, I want one case of 500 different products, right? Well, Dot carries all 500 of those products. So they can build a pallet of all those products together and put them on a truck. While if you're a manufacturer, imagine shipping one case of product, you'd be like, this isn't worth my time. I'm not doing this. So they create a ton of efficiencies for not only Sysco, but they also create it for the manufacturer, which is Wawa in this scenario.
And there are other redistributors out there too, besides Dot Foods, several of them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, great. And so probably the last part of this, as we wind it down, what really strikes me is the brand that you all are building, right? Again, I kind of, what's ringing in my head is Starbucks and that brand that's been created there, right? And don't get me wrong, I think Pastry Arts Coffee, everything is much better than Starbucks. Another shameless plug.
I bet it is.
But the brand that Starbucks is just remarkable. Mm-hmm. What would you say the best practices have been in creating this brand? I mean, was the idea from the beginning to create this brand, or are you falling into it? But it just seems like the pieces are falling right in line for you all.
Yeah. The goal was definitely always to create the brand. If you've seen the Wawa logo, it's honestly a phenomenal logo. And before I worked at Wawa, I always would walk by the stores in Chicago and be like, that's a great logo. You know, it just, it has kind of that appeal to it. And I think with Asian food, a lot of the times the brand is really important because for a lot of people, it's new, something new that they haven't really had before. And what makes you trust something that's new is a brand or something that you trust. And I think even Starbucks does that is like the, for an example, like Costco sells the Starbucks egg bites, right? Those like sous vide little eggs. And Starbucks released those and no one had an issue with those, you know, eggs basically boiled in water and eating it. And everyone's like, oh, it's Starbucks. They're great. But if a random coffee shop released those, I'm sure there wouldn't be as much of a demand for it, right? They wouldn't have gone as national. So a brand that Wawa has created, I think it gives a lot of validity to the product. And a cheeseburger bao, most time I say that to somebody and they're like, whoa, what? Like, that's weird. I'm not trying that or something like that. But with Wawa, you're like, hey, I'll try the cheeseburger bao. And every time somebody tries the cheeseburger bao, they tell me, wow, this is the greatest thing I've ever had. And I go, I know it is. It tastes like a McDonald's cheeseburger or something. So the brand has always been the forefront of Wawa. And our CEO always tells me, you know, he's gotten requests all through the years that XX company wants to put bao on their menu. And he's told them no, because he wants the brand to carry the product. And, you know, if random company X puts bao on their menu and gives no credit to Wawa, that doesn't help us grow our brand, right? It could even, it hurts the brand. It's like, oh, I got bao at this restaurant. I think it's better. And little does the customer know it's the same bao, but who knows, their mood could have been better that day. So keeping the brand a forefront has been definitely a decision that was made 15 years ago to not make ourselves a commodity, for lack of a better term, right? Bao is Wawa, and Wawa is bao. Best way to put it.
Nice. And so maybe some of those best practices around your brand and this mission, the things I just wrote down is it's important to protect your brand.
Definitely.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you just alluded to how you're very selective with your customer base. And that helps because the brand is more important than
it is
perhaps the next dollar.
And that's hard sometimes with growth, because you want to grow as fast as possible, but the brand is so important too. And you always, it's easy to lose sight of that. And that's something that Jeff does a great job of always reminding me is, you know, the brand is what makes Wawa. So we need to always think of the brand as we grow that we're doing it in the right way and we're making the right decision for the brand of Wawa.
Yeah. And the other, if I may, best practice that I kind of wrote down, and then maybe I'll give you a chance if there's any others I'm missing, is the brand is more than the product. And it seems to me, and I'll say this again, that Wawa is a fun place to work. Mm-hmm. And knowing Andy, who's the CFO, I've known Andy for a number of years. The people, the employees are part of the brand. Can you, definitely. Is that fair to say? Can you expound on that?
Yeah, definitely. And it's a culture I think that's been instilled, obviously since I've been here, but for a longer time than that, is that Wawa is, it's fun. You can kind of, you can do, I want to think of the right way to say this, but you have a lot of autonomy at Wawa. You know, if you're doing your job right, you can do things and try things and test things. And that's always something that's been instilled in me from our leadership down is, you know, you have an idea, like, go do it. And that's not the case at a lot of companies. A lot of companies like want you to stay on a straight track. And I remember Jeff, our CEO, told me one time, he's like, you know, the Google methodology is, you know, 75% of the time you're doing your job and the other 25% of the time you're doing your idea or working on something you have an idea for. And that's kind of the same culture that Wawa creates, is there's a job and it needs to get done every day, but what's next, right? What's in the last 3 years, we've launched new items, we've created new flavors, right? There's always has to be something next. So why not have the people in the company thinking about it instead of, you know, let the outside world tell you what's next, because they're usually a little bit late.
That's Steve Jobs kind of thinking right there too, right?
Exactly.
Like, we're going to tell them what they want.
That's the let us entertain you. They always, I, Jeff, our CEO, and our chef, Tim Hockett, they've been let us entertain you employees before Wawa for 20 plus years. And their whole thing is, we tell the customer what they want. That's what let us entertain, because they don't know yet, right? The customer doesn't know they're ready to like XX dish, right? Carbonara used to not be a dish on Italian restaurant menus for a long time. And who said that Americans were ready to eat carbonara on the menu, right? Somebody was like, we're just putting it on the menu and they're going to like it because it's good. And that's kind of the same methodology that we take a lot of the time.
Yep. And then one more word that just kind of struck me, even though Wawa's now in business for 20 years, is speed. Can you talk about the importance of speed for your brand?
It's one of the most important things, is it comes with everything, is the speed to cook the bao, right? And the speed to get to market and just how fast pace we move. It's kind of one of our, it's almost like a culture here, is we move fast and we expect our employees to move fast and we expect our partners to move fast with us. And there's failure along the way, like anything, but we look at speed as one of our advantages. And if we have speed to market and we can get to market faster than other companies, especially in like retail, or expand our ghost kitchens from zero to 500 plus in 3 years, right? Somebody else can't do it. So it couldn't be more of a culture thing with us. And it's just fun that the bao also is a speed. You know, you can eat it on the go, right? You don't have to have a plate and a fork and a knife. It's also made for speed. So,
yeah. And I heard the word failure, right? And failure is fail fast, right? Jeff Bezos would say, or will say, it's better to move with speed and fail fast than it is to think it all the way through and be right.
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 And that's the key, is failing fast and knowing when it's something isn't working. So that's what we try to pride ourselves on.
Yeah. Remarkable. So lastly, if I'm a restaurateur, whatever it may be, how do we get in touch with Wawa?
Yeah. So our website's the best place to go. Wawa.com. You're a consumer that wants to say, hey, can I go to a grocery store near me, or can I find a dark kitchen near me to order from? We have a locations page there. If you want to partner with us, either from a grocery perspective or from a dark kitchen perspective, we have a submission form on our website that you can fill out, and our team will be in contact almost immediately. But that's the place for all things Wawa, and we have some fun stuff coming on the website, so I'd bookmark it and find it, because I'll tease it here. We have possibly a chance to win free bao for a year coming live here in Q1, so you don't want to miss that.
Cool. And you heard it here.
Yeah, you heard it here first.
On Farm to Fork to Innovators. That's right. You heard it here first.
Yep. I might have to email you and say that has to be cut, because once my marketing team finds out that I released it.
Great. All right. Well, Brandon, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah. No, thanks, David. Thanks for everything.
And that brings us to the end of another insightful journey through the fields of innovation on Farm to Fork, The Innovators. It's an honor to have you listen. If you found today's episode as fascinating as we did, don't forget to share it with a friend, write a review, and hit that subscribe button so you never miss another episode. Farm to Fork is not just a podcast. It's a community of forward thinkers and change makers. Your thoughts and ideas matter to us. Reach out on social media or through our website, datumfs.com, and be a part of the ongoing conversation. As we wrap up today, remember, the future of the food supply chain is in our hands. Stay curious, stay innovative, and let's continue growing together. Until next time, this is David Maloney signing off from Farm to Fork, The Innovators. Thank you for being a part of this community. See you in the next episode.